This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hello everybody, welcome back to another episode of Code of the Unknown. I'm your host Simon Wammers here. One of my writers, in this case Katie, writes me a script. David Gunn Lewis, Mystery Man. I'm going to read it, and I've never read it before. I know nothing about that. That's the format of the show. It's a cold read. We're going to explore together. It's going to be a fun time. Look, if you love this show, why not leave it a review? And hey, if you're watching on YouTube, why not subscribe? Look at that. Get in those plugs in at the beginning, like a professional. An odd little mystery, this. When I first read the details, while they were strange, I thought it was pretty clear what had happened, and I even debated dropping it, as it was a bit sad and depressing. Okay, I'll adjust from my upbeat tone then. But then I read more theories and delved into the nitty-gritty, and it seemed that my immediate take was not necessarily correct, and there might, in fact, be conspiracy theories ahoy. After all, if you are already familiar with this story, I doubt you'll find much new here, as practically every article and blog post I read bemoans the lack of information. But hey, they reckons without the old fact boy tangents, my ability to just believe the most recent piece of information I hear or read. Excellent quality in a writer there, a researcher. After reviewing all of the information, what do you believe? The most recent one, the last thing I read. That's how it works. This story is about David Glenn Lewis. Who, what, where, why, how? Exactly. Let's get on with it. Are people familiar with this? I don't know this. David Glenn Lewis? Never heard of him. RIP, John Doe. Or R.I.B. I much prefer pronouncing it RIP. RIP! On the 1st of February 1993, a man was seen along Route 24, a two-lane highway out in the boonies near the small community of Moxie, Washington, United States. Reports vary as to whether he was walking down the center of the road or lying in the middle of it, but a couple of motorists were alarmed enough that they tried to turn around and warn oncoming traffic about him. Unfortunately, it was too late, and he was hit and killed by a car, the driver of which was never found. When police arrived on the scene, they found that the man was wearing what looked like military fatigues and work boots. I find it strange that someone would hit and run that, because it's like, bro, if you're just driving along, boop, 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 boop. Oh, maybe they had a reason to hit and run. Like, if they were drunk, or if they were driving on a suspended license, or they'd stolen the car or something, then I get it. But let's say, I guess the drunk thing's the most likely, isn't it? But if I was driving along the motorway, not that I'd hit and run someone anyway, even if I was at fault, because holy shit. But if I was driving along the motorway, and there's a dude, and it's night, and there's a dude lying down in the street, and I hit him and kill him, I'm not going to feel particularly bad about that, because assuming I'm going the speed limit, I'm driving safely, blah, blah, blah. Because, bro, what you do in lying in the street, and then to hit and run, it's like, suddenly what went from not a crime went to like, uh-oh, that's a big crime. When basic tests were run, he was found to have no drugs or alcohol in his system. He wasn't carrying any form of ID, and nothing came up when they ran his fingerprints. Eventually, after taking a few photos and tissue samples of the body, the man was buried as a John Doe near Yakima, Washington, with a few strangers in attendance. A sad and lonely end for this unknown person. Do they really have funerals for, like, or like a service when it's just an unknown John Doe body? Who are these strangers? Who goes? If you just attend random funerals, I would be slightly worried about your mental status. Like, who do you know? Do you know this person? No. I just enjoy funerals. Just I don't know, something about them. They got a good vibe, don't they? No. This is something that is for sure going to kick off the conspiracy theory people, because he's wearing military fatigues, and Did they say they looked like military fatigues? Or, yeah, what looked like military fatigues? And people will be like, oh my God, this is a secret government military thing. And it's like, no, I probably just went to the army surplus store and bought some camouflage. Like when you're driving around, you see someone wearing camo, are you immediately like, he's a soldier? Or are you immediately like, no, he's a hunter or a fisherman, or he just thinks camo is stylish because his brain is in 1998. I don't think, this is why conspiracy theories are stupid. Rewind. Is this like, this is how it's written? It's like, reminds me of that, God, speaking of the 90s, isn't it like, rewind. When the crowd say something, selection, something like this. Oh my God, it's been a good 20 years. On this same day of the 1st of February, 1993, many hundreds of miles away in Amarillo, Texas, family man, lawyer, former judge, and all-round community good fellow David Glenn Lewis had just been reported missing. It had been a Super Bowl weekend, and while that means nothing to most people, it's apparently a big deal over in the States, where an hour of sport gets dragged out into a four-hour television marathon. A free-flowing game, it ain't. Anyway, David Lewis had been home alone for the weekend, while his wife and daughter had been having a girls' trip out to Dallas. On the day of the final, which was the 31st of January, David set the record button on whatever old-school VCR he had in the early 90s, and maybe thought about eating one of the turkey sandwiches he'd made earlier and that were currently sitting in the fridge. Okay, interesting detail. What was he thinking about? Turkey sandwiches in the fridge. I guess this is relevant somehow. And then he disappeared. We do have some eyewitness accounts of a few of his movements and activities across that weekend, but they seem to raise more questions than answers. Let's go through a factual timeline of known sightings and other bits and bobs of information that came to light as the investigation commenced. The known timeline. Most of the stories I've read about this case all contain practically the same timeline information, seemingly taken from an article in the Del Rio News Herald, published about 6 months after David's disappearance on the 27th of June 1993. The headline is "Baffling Trail Stumps Police Searching for Missing Attorney." And yeah, it's pretty baffling. I'm also mentioning this to again highlight the lack of diverse sources of information about the case. While we can get into some more free-flowing ideas later on, this part of the story is pretty well trodden in terms of language used, so if you've seen or heard about it somewhere else, there probably aren't any new developments coming your way. Is this some super famous disappearance case? I've never heard of this. I feel like we cover stuff and it's like, yeah, I know about that, vaguely heard of that. Mostly because I've just made loads of videos and things come up, you know, these big famous ones come up again and again. I never heard of this. On Thursday, January the 28th, 1993, David left work early as he said he felt ill. Just a quick note, the law firm he worked at was called Buckner, Lara and Swindle. I just thought Swindle was a slightly unfortunate name if you're a lawyer, so I like to swindle someone out of money. I didn't even put that together. Maybe it'd be pronounced Swindell. So you're at the Swindle law firm? It's Swindell. Yeah, I feel like that would hurt your chances of becoming named partner if your name was Swindle. It's like, what's your name? I'm Mr. Joe Scam, Esquire of Scam and Scam Attorneys. Anyway, he didn't seem to be totally bedridden, as there's a record of him going to the gas station, and then he had obviously recovered enough that day because he taught his evening class at Amarillo College, which finished at 10 p.m. Karen and Lauren Lewis left for their Dallas trip that same day and didn't see David after he originally left for work that morning. On Friday the 29th of January 1993, at least according to this Del Rio News Herald article, a friend of David's had seen him hurrying through the Southwest Airlines terminal at Amarillo's airport. He was not carrying luggage. Later that night, at about 10:30 p.m., a car matching David's, a red Ford Explorer, was seen by a police officer parked outside a county courts building, and no flags had been raised yet. This was just an observation at the time. Wait, so they saw him at an airport? You'd assume he's at an airport to go somewhere, and then they saw his car later on? Weird. I mean, someone else could be driving his car, but he was home alone, so he would be... On Saturday the 30th of January 1993, the red Ford Explorer was no longer at the courthouse, and neighbors of the Lewises confirmed that their car had been parked outside their house that day. A sum of $5,000 was deposited into the Lewises' bank account, but seemingly no one can prove who did this. While it isn't mentioned in the newspaper article, but came up in the police investigation shortly after, a plane ticket was bought on this day under the name of David Lewis, and it was from Dallas to Amarillo. And that's strange, there is a ticket from... Dallas to Amarillo, right? Because that's where his wife and daughter were going for their girls' weekend, so why would he ever... I mean, it could just... David Lewis is not a super uncommon name, but it is a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? Now, we can't be sure that it was the same David Lewis, of course, and it's unclear whether the ticket was purchased on that day or booked for a flight that left on that day. 1993 isn't that long ago, but it's in a frustrating era for investigations like these, as there wasn't so much airport security and people could fly between states without showing ID or even their real names. The timing is interesting, though, as we'll come back to these breadcrumbs. So let's crack on for now. Past. It's like, yeah, no, you can just get on a plane, not showing any ID. It's like, oh my God, times have changed. Like 1993 was a long time ago. On the morning of Sunday, January the 31st, 1993, the red Ford Explorer was again seen outside the Potter County Courts building, and this time, a sheriff's deputy saw someone who looked a lot like David Lewis taking photos of it. I mean, given that that's where he lives, right? Given that he drives a red Ford Explorer, and given that someone who looks like him is taking pictures of it, there's got to be him, right? What are the odds? Later that day, at the Lewis household, someone recorded the start of the Super Bowl at 5:15 p.m. It has been taken for granted that David was physically in the house to do this, although I'm pretty sure my parents' video recorder had a timer so you could set the remote control in the early 90s, and we weren't even super fancy early adopters or anything like that. Yeah, you definitely could. There would be like, you could just set the time on it, because you could look in the TV guide, find something on in the middle of the night that you wanted to watch, and it would record it automatically. I definitely did this in the 90s. Apparently, the Lewis's VCR didn't have the fancy bells and whistles on it that my modest family machine did, and there wasn't a timer function on it. This is a hotly debated point, as it marks the difference between knowing where he was on the 31st of January and having absolutely no idea where he was. But let's assume he was at home, as there are a few other pointers. His wife and daughter arrived back later that evening, and at first, nothing seemed amiss. The game was being recorded, they found some turkey sandwiches in the fridge, there was laundry in the dryer, and David's watch and wedding ring were by the sink as he habitually took them off to do the washing up. This is good to know, as if I came home to find my husband's watch and ring on the side, I'd immediately assume he'd left me. Why would you take your watch off, though? It's like, that's not a... is it? Karen was not fazed and just assumed that David was working late or had gone to watch the game with a friend or something. On Monday, February the 1st, 1993, Karen Lewis was notified that David had missed a couple of work appointments. Wait... so we go from Sunday to Monday, and he's just like, hey, I went to watch the game with a friend. And then it's Monday? What happened on Sunday night? Was she not worried about where her husband was? He's just gone out, and he'd never came back. This was unlike him, and due to the fact that she hadn't seen him the previous day, she called the police to report him missing. On this day, I'd be so worried. Oh my God, if my wife didn't come back, like, one evening, and I expected her back, I'd be like, uh-oh. I'd call the police that day. On this day, another airline ticket was purchased under the name David Lewis, but this time it was from LA to Dallas with a stop in Amarillo. Once again, it's not clear if it was purchased that day or if it was for a flight that left on that day, nor is it clear if it was our David Lewis who bought the ticket. And still, even more unclear is if this ticket or the previous one was ever actually used. Police investigate, it's amazing the lack of tracking on airline stuff back in the day. Police investigating David's disappearance quickly found his car parked again outside the court building. Inside was his driver's license, checkbook, credit cards, the gas, and his house and car keys. To me, this would again scream disappearance, or maybe even that he'd taken his own life. Yeah, this sounds like he left his shit at home, he left his shit in the car, and he's just vanished into the wind, which, that's pretty intense. He's just decided to disappear, so he's probably got a new ID and all of this stuff and just starting a new life. Apparently, though, this was again common practice for just David to leave all his crap in the car, including his keys. Did this man not have at least one pocket about his person? This doesn't feel fair. I often leave my keys in the car. Like, if I'm going somewhere and I don't need my car key, if I've got my house keys on me and the car key's separate because it's little, I'll leave my house keys in the, like, little center console compartment thing, because it's like, I know I'm coming back to my car later, and then when I'm at my house, I'll just take the keys with me, like, when I get out of the car, and then I don't have to carry the keys around in my pocket. And I'm always like, you know, it's like, there's a key for the main building, there's two locks on there, there's a postbox key, there's my office keys, and it's like, I don't want to carry that shit around if I don't have to. It looks stupid in a pocket, because you got your wallet in there as well. I don't even carry a wallet anymore, I just carry my phone. I'm like, I don't carry shit. I don't know anything about Amarillo, but I guess that car smash and grabs have been a thing since people started parking cars. So why leave all your important personal belongings in there? Take your belongings with you, folks, and always lock your car. Yeah, I always lock my car. But I mean, I'm not going to leave cash on display. But my car parked somewhere else with my house and office keys in it, they're not going to be of any use to someone because they're going to be like, well, where does he live? And I don't keep like, my ID doesn't have, oh, does my ID have my address on it? I don't think so. It definitely doesn't have my office address on it. So I don't know. I'm not particularly worried about that. Maybe I should be. Actually, maybe my car registration documents does have my address in it. So if someone broke in, they could steal that. They could steal my keys. But then if someone stole my keys, then I'll get my locks changed. So I don't know. I'm not so worried about this. Anyway, this was not considered suspicious behavior. And in fact, when the police also became aware of the plane tickets, they chalked the whole thing up to a voluntary disappearance, i.e. David Glenn Lewis had decided that for whatever reason, he was ditching this life and moving on to something new of his own volition. Suicide was also suspected, although as no new leads were uncovered, the case went cold after about 11 months. The family had a different take on things, however. Karen Lewis is quoted in the Del Rio News Herald as saying, "All the family suspect foul play. We have from day one." Karen was convinced that David had been kidnapped or at least forced to flee into hiding by unsavory characters. What sort of lawyer is he? Is he a lawyer who just does like, you know, there's a big difference between, yeah, he's a lawyer and he's representing some guy who is a whistleblower for the mafia versus, nah, he looks at contracts for a bank. You know, it's a big difference. And also, I feel like the family are always ones, they'll be like, he'd never do anything like that. And it's like, yeah, no, he's having a whole secret life, mate. Like, people do this. It happens. I'm not saying that is what happened. I'm saying that is a possibility. During his time as a judge, he had received death threats from disgruntled convicts, and at the time of his disappearance, he was waiting to be deposed in a multi-million dollar case that had been brought against him, some other lawyers, and an industrial client Lewis had represented. Karen Lewis also later said that his files on this case had also disappeared. The only other thing that seemed to be missing was some green sweatpants. No other clothing or possessions of any kind. Wait, she's saying that this backs up the idea that he'd been kidnapped. Well, when someone's kidnapped, there's a demand. They don't just kidnap people for fun. So that's not what, I don't think it's a kidnapping. Whether he's been taken away and murdered because of something like a disgruntled person, maybe. I don't think that's particularly likely. However, should we consider that he is being sued for many millions of dollars, and that maybe that's why he wants to disappear and start a new life, because he doesn't want to lose everything he has, and that maybe by getting rid of those documents or whatever, maybe it means that his, I don't know. I don't know why you'd get rid of those, but maybe there's something there. Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Notion. Notion is an all-in-one team collaboration tool that combines note-taking, document sharing, wikis, project management, and more into one space that's simple, powerful, and beautifully designed. And I can think of all of these tools that you use for all of these separate things. And you have like many tabs open. Like, okay, I go here and then I put in a link here and I do that and I do this. No. Just use Notion. It brings it all into one place. And what do they say about this? Beautifully designed. What more could you want? Notion's customizable workspace can be tailored to realize any workplace OKRs or major life events. And if that was not enough for you, they've also got a worldwide network of millions of users who constantly create templates, tutorials, and inspiration, which means it's just getting better all the time. Notion will make you more efficient. It'll make you more productive at work. And, you know, what really sets Notion apart is that it seamlessly transitions from a workplace power tool and even to a game changer for your personal life. Look, if you're dreaming, working, planning, building, just whatever you're doing, Notion is just the collaboration tool, the note-taking tool, the wiki tool, the project management tool, the everything tool that makes it all possible. Look, just go to Notion.com, get started for free today. Again, Notion.com to start today for free. Notion.com to take the first step toward organized, productive work and life today.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
And now back to today's episode. After the case went cold, the Lewis family would not have any significant news until 2004, a whopping 11 years after David was reported missing. One man, two mysteries. So far, you may not think that this case is particularly worthy of a place here in Decoding the Unknown, although we did one about a guy who made it rain indoors, so maybe the bar is not that high. Yeah, that was a silly episode. It's like, yeah, no, he can make shit rain inside. It's like, no, he can't. It doesn't matter what you say, he can't. It's physically impossible. It's pipes. It's leaking pipes, and everything else is just people misremembering and blowing stories out of proportion. But here's the weird ending to the story. In 2003, a decade after David's disappearance, Washington-based detective Pat Ditter was reading an article about how hard it had been to solve missing person cases through the existing database and how so many people ended up falling through the cracks. He decided to try using the internet to see if he could clear any of his local caseload, and he turned to Google, which I guess was still pretty newfangled in 2003. I mean, 1993 sounds quite recent to me, but at the time of writing, it was nearly 20 years ago. Do you mean 2003? Because 1993 was nearly 30 years ago. I don't know, 1993, I was 6 years old in 1993. Seems like a really long time ago. Like, Google being new seems like a long ass time ago. Me being six, I'm almost middle-aged. There were a few unidentified person cases that he concentrated on and put what was known about their physical characteristics into the search engine to see if he could tally them up with anyone classed as a missing person. And bingo, after a few days he cracked a long cold case wide open, but in the process added even more questions to the story. You might have guessed, but the man dressed in military style who was killed in the hit and run and buried in Washington in 1993 was none other than David Glenn Lewis. Oh my god, I totally forgot how this episode started. Yes. From what has been reported of his timeline, he was in his house at 5:15 p.m. on Sunday, January the 31st, and the next day he was hit by a car nearly 1,600 miles away from home. What on earth had happened in the meantime? We'll take a look at some leading theories, but I'll just quickly mop up the story first. Maybe some sort of mental break, like he had something and he just lost his mind. It can happen. Detective Ditter found the missing persons report on David Lewis and was pretty sure that it was his John Doe who had been languishing in an unvisited grave for over a decade. David Lewis, who wore those snazzy big old glasses with the double bar at the top, and which are technically aviator glasses, but that would indicate that these looked cool when they really didn't. Anyway, David needed specs to see, and the John Doe hadn't been wearing any. There was a note about them in his file, though, and luckily his clothes had been saved, and found some big old glasses in with the clothes the John Doe was wearing when he died. He sent a DNA sample from one of the man's boots and tissue sample that had been preserved to the police in Amarillo. They compared it with Lewis's mother, and yes, it was a match. John Doe had been identified, and David Glenn Lewis had finally been found. He was reburied in Westlawn Memorial Park in Texas in 2004. The theories. So let's go through the two main theories before talking about what I assumed had happened. The first theory is that there was foul play involved. His wife and family have believed this from the moment it happened. So why are they so convinced? There are a few things that point toward David having been kidnapped or being forced to leave against his will. At his house, nothing at all was missing apart from those green sweatpants which he might have put on to watch the game. This might indicate that he left with just what he was wearing. The timing of his disappearance is also quite suspicious. It was just a week before this disposition that he was going to give, and the fact that all the paperwork relating to the case also vanished does seem fishy. He was apparently the last person left to be deposed. I haven't found out much about this case, but apparently it was his former law firm that he was supposed to be giving evidence against in a conflict of interest case. David was representing a client from the oil industry. Wait, did I totally misread that? I thought the lawsuit was against him. Yeah, he deposed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit that had been brought against him, some other lawyers, and an industrial client Lewis had represented. So, okay, I'm not really sure. According to his wife, to whom he had been married to for about 12 years, he had received death threats during his time as a judge, and she thought it more than possible that he could have picked up enemies from any number of his cases, projects, or even from inside his own firm. David worked on lots of community programs, including being a member of the Moore County Child Protective Services Board, and he was also chairman of Safe Places, Inc., which assisted people fleeing from domestic violence and sexual abuse situations. So you can see where his life might have rubbed up against some potentially dangerous, or at least very angry people. Karen Lewis did also say that he had mentioned getting death threats again not long before his disappearance, but he never told her who they were from. We only have her word about it. It's also possible she was just saying that to give a bit more weight to her theory. So let's say he was settling down to watch the game when someone turned up and kidnapped him. How and why, then, did he end up 1,600 miles away in just over 24 hours? While it is possible to drive from Amarillo to Moxie in exactly 24 hours, thank you Google Maps, that would mean constant driving through the night with no traffic. I suppose the kidnappers could have taken shifts, but where they were going and why is totally unknown. If this is the theory we're going with, David was dumped or escaped at some point and was wandering down the middle of the highway when he was killed. Now he flew. Like, what are the chances of it just happening to be 24-hour straight drive with no traffic, no stops, nothing like that? I guess Google Maps is only considering that you do the speed limit, but also if you have someone you've kidnapped in the back, you're going to be doing the speed limit. We also have to assume that the hit and run was totally accidental, as why drive over 1,500 miles then run someone over in front of witnesses? Apparently a Chevrolet Camaro was thought to be the car that hit him, but no further clues have been found, and while the driver might have panicked and fled the scene, it's also possible that they had no idea they'd hit a person and might have thought it was a deer or something, as that particular road is dark and people like to speed along it. Yeah, okay, fair enough. At the beginning I was like, why would you hit and run? And now there are reasons. So maybe they took a plane. Yakima Air Terminal is only about 10 minutes from where David was found. This seems unlikely in a kidnapping scenario, unless the kidnappers had a private plane, of course. If they went commercial, well, I don't know about the route in 1993, if you wanted to go from Amarillo to Yakima today, there are two stops en route, hardly conducive to an easy kidnapping. Also, about the paperwork, it could be anywhere. Karen Lewis left on a trip on the 28th of January. David had at least 2 days to do something with his documents. Maybe he took them to the office or put them in a locker to keep them safe until his deposition. To me, though, that doesn't really scream cover-up. And while he was supposed to be showing up to represent Big Oil in this court case, it was allegedly not a big deal and nobody would have benefited from David's disappearance. I still think he just left. I don't think there's foul play. I really don't. I think that's the family hoping there was to kind of explain it rather than him just being like, I'm done. I don't know. Just from an objective perspective, that doesn't seem super likely. Let's move on to the police's belief that he left Amarillo voluntarily. This was the conclusion they decided on after finding out someone using the name David Lewis had bought those plane tickets. There was also an account from a taxi driver that he drove a man matching David's description to Dallas Airport from a hotel. Apparently, the man was acting nervously and paid with a $100 bill, of which he had a big watch. Detective James Smith, who worked on the case, is quoted in the Del Rio News Herald stating, "It has a lot of earmarkings of suicide. People don't always do what you'd expect. That definitely rings true, but why would Lewis go all the way to Washington to kill himself? He had no ties at all, personally or professionally, with anything or anyone in that state. So what was the point? He wanted to go to somewhere that didn't mean anything to him?" Smith pointed to the fact that Lewis's business maybe wasn't going as well as he hoped, and had also recently failed to win back his seat as a judge. Lewis also was involved in a lot of other programs and stuff, as I've already mentioned, but when I say a lot, I mean a lot, and it's exhausting reading through all of the stuff he was doing. As well as being a lawyer and teaching in college, here's a list of the stuff he was involved with according to his memorial. He was an active member of Dumas Chamber of Commerce, Dumas Noon Lions Club, Dumas Discovery Center, board member, former president of Dumas and Moore County United Way, chairman of Safe Place Inc., member of the First Baptist Church in Dumas, teaching at the adult fourth Sunday school class, was active in the sanctuary choir and adult ensemble. He was an organizer and advisor of the Moore County Teen Court, was on the board of directors for the Dumas County Community Education Advisory Council, and was a district chairman of the Golden Spread Council of the Boy Scouts of America from 1986 to 1993. Oh my god, I do nothing. It's like, what? My memorial site, what did he do? Spent time with his family and worked. That's it. I don't do any clubs. I don't do any shit like this. I mean, wow, maybe he was just stretched really thin and couldn't keep up, or was experiencing issues in one or more areas of his extremely busy life, and it all got on top of him. None of these are like things where you'd expect him to run into any let's disappear trouble, though, is there? It seems much more likely that it was work or just the fuck it, I'm out midlife crisis. You know, I'm just like, rather than buying a Porsche, he decided that he was going to just abandon his life and start a new life somewhere else. Maybe. Speculation. So maybe we can see why he might want to have get away from it all. Maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, but then his actions still make no sense. Why go to Washington? And those plane tickets are still really bugging me. Let's combine these two theories together a bit and look at a strand where David did leave voluntarily, but maybe he was going into hiding to protect himself and or his family. This is one of the very few scenarios in which the plane tickets make sense. Remember that two tickets under the name David Lewis were bought on the day of his disappearance and the day he was reported missing. The first was from Dallas to Amarillo. If David was at home in Amarillo, why would he have bought this ticket? His wife and daughter were coming from Dallas, but it's not clear if they drove or flew. And if they flew, why would he only buy one ticket for them? If he had needed to buy a ticket for them, this would have been mentioned by his wife. The other ticket was from LA to Dallas via Amarillo. This is totally odd. If he was buying for someone else, wouldn't he have done it under their name so they could use it? Does it matter though? Didn't we just say earlier that they're not checking IDs? It's just like a bus ticket. Like, it doesn't say your name on it. It's just you're like, I've got a ticket. There is my seat. I will sit in my seat. No one's matching it against ID, so you could buy it and then just give it to someone else. Also, how was he going to get to LA and then fly back to Amarillo? One suggestion here is that he was trying to throw people off the scent. This does sort of make sense. As I mentioned before, there was no real security or rigorous ID checks done when flying internally in the States in 1993. He could have bought himself a ticket to Yakima Air Terminal for reasons unknown under a totally different name, then just bought a couple of random flights under his name to make it look like he was going to be somewhere he wasn't. This is all assuming, of course, that the David Lewis that bought the tickets was our David Lewis. I think this is pretty accurate. I still think it's more likely that he just decided. I don't think he's trying to throw anyone off other than people who might want to, like, hire a private investigator like his family to find out where he buggered off to. Maybe. It does seem that the only way he could have been where he was at the time of his death was by flying, though. If he drove himself, he would have needed to hire a car, as his Ford Explorer was left in Amarillo. His driver's license was still inside the car, and even though air travel security was pretty slack, he probably would have needed some form of ID and a driver's license to rent a car. His photo and name were put out there early on in the investigation, and presumably police checked plates like local car rental agencies. No record of him renting a car or of anyone matching his description has emerged. Even if he did have a car, it's unlikely that he'd be able to make it to Moxie in time for his rendezvous with the Almighty. As mentioned earlier, it's doable, but he would have had to drive for 24 hours straight with no brakes and no traffic delays. It just doesn't sound likely. So why was he in Washington? Was it his planned final destination or just a stop along the way? Were the people he was hiding from real threats or imagined? I think he wanted to disappear. He bought plane tickets in his name to throw people off, and then he probably bought another plane ticket in cash in someone else's name to Washington, being like, yeah, John Smith, because apparently in the past you could just do that. And he hops on a plane, goes to Washington, and his disappearance would have been complete if he hadn't been hit by a car. The much-used Del Rio News Herald article finishes with another quote from Detective Smith. I ain't got any plans, just nowhere else to go. He was talking about the case going cold, by the way, not what he was doing for the weekend. Still, kind of a limp note for an investigation to end on. This now leads to what I immediately thought when I read this story for the first time. The actions are odd. He was found in the middle of nowhere with clothes on that were not his. Surely this all points to some sort of psychological breakdown. The clothes thing, by the way, while strange, is not really a big deal. There is an army training center in Yakima, an army airfield, and all sorts of other military stuff around, so there are military surplus stores too. David could have easily picked up his fatigues near the airport before walking, driving, or hitchhiking to where he was last found. Anyway, let's get back to this theory, which makes the most sense for me. For my money, David Lewis was experiencing a dissociative fugue. This is pretty rare, but when it does happen, it causes people to basically forget who they are and have the pressing need to flee from their current location. Fugue comes from the Latin fuga, which means act of fleeing, and it certainly seems to fit into our mystery man's actions. People who suffer from dissociative fugues are often under intense mental pressure or stress, which, while we can't know for sure, it does seem like David was a candidate for with everything that was going on in his life at that point. Yeah, this is fair. So my assumption was he did this voluntarily. And if we just throw in this fugue thing, which we mentioned in a previous video, is vanishingly rare, but obviously it does sometimes happen. And this could be one of those cases. So it's sort of voluntary, but also it just throws in that mental state element. But does that mean it'd really have been so smart to buy like different plane tickets going places? To throw people off? Can they do that? Can someone do that in a fugue? According to WebMD, symptoms of dissociative fugue include sudden and unplanned travel away from home, confusion or loss of memory about their identity, possibly assuming a new identity to make up for the loss. So that, to me, indicates he couldn't have bought those plane tickets to throw the people off because maybe he didn't know who his identity was. And if you're like that, then I don't think you're going to have the presence of mind to buy tickets to throw people off. I really don't. So if you ask me, the armchair expert, David experienced a case of dissociative fugue and left his house with nothing more than what he was wearing. This state can last less than a day or can drag on for months, but it might have already started happening to him as people spotted him acting erratically, like rushing through his local airport without any luggage, taking photos of his car and paying his cab driver from a stack of hundreds. He then somehow made it to Washington State, got some different clothes, and ended up walking down the highway. He wasn't wearing his glasses when he was hit. Maybe he was purposefully trying to kill himself, or maybe in his fugue he thought he didn't need them. I'm not sure how far amnesia goes, but I haven't heard that it cures myopia. Also, while I was wondering why neither the police nor his wife had thought of this, I realized I was reading the story already knowing the ending. They had no idea that a person killed in a hit and run several states over was David. All they knew at the time was that he was missing, so I suppose I'll cut them some slack. I just think he chose to disappear. I understand where Katie's coming from with the fugue thing, but I think, one, that's unlikely, and two, there are these elements of planning, which I'm not sure, and obviously I don't know much about fugues. I don't know if it'd have had the presence of mind to do. And also the stack of hundreds and stuff, putting together a bunch of cash because until he gets a new identity or whatever, however you get that. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. So what do you think? A kidnapping gone wrong? A paranoid David abruptly leaving for reasons real or imaginary? A total disassociative fugue which sent him running to a place he had no formal links to? A combination of some or all of these? All we know for sure is that one day David Glenn Lewis was at home in Amarillo, and the next day he was lying dead on a road 1,600 miles away. How he got there and why will probably remain a mystery. Yes, and that's where we end today's video. Thank you so much for watching or listening. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, like. If you're listening to it in its podcast form, please leave a review, and I'll see you next time.
Have you ever stumbled upon a story that's just too weird to be true?
But too intriguing to ignore?
I'm Laura Anderson.
And I'm Tom Reynolds. Together, we're the hosts of Wanna Hear Something Weird?
A new podcast where we venture into the heart of mind-bending mysteries.
From peculiar legends to ghostly encounters, we try to separate fact from fiction.
Join us on a journey into the bizarre. Listen to Wanna Hear Something Weird wherever you get your podcasts.